G'day, Indy Wood is my name. Welcome to what is the first of hopefully many podcasts from The Local Update, produced by Indy Media and soon to be a radio program on 93.7 Edge FM, looking at local issues and events taking place around the Bega Valley. I won't be on my own. Over the ensuing weeks, I'm going to set up a bit of a regular catch-up with Ian Campbell from Bega Valley Shire Council. We'll also check in with Ben Smythe, the editor of the Bega District News, or perhaps some of his journos, to find out what's been making news around the Bega Valley on a semi-regular basis. And to kick things off this week, what I hope will be the first of many catch-ups with Graham Farram, one of the long-term members of the Bega Pioneers Museum. Graham regularly does a bit of poetry reading and reading from books, non-fiction books, looking at where Bega made its stamp on history over the past. So let's kick things off right there with Graham Farram. This week, Graham is going to start things off by reading a bit of poetry by one of his favourite from the past, Mr. Henry Lawson.
A couple of weeks back, I did a poem called The Bushfire by Henry Lawson. And, of course, we've just suffered through a number of bushfires down here. Fire doesn't change the way it behaves. It's certainly the same sort of thing that Lawson recorded back at the turn of the 20th century. But on the facing page of that book, the preceding page, it's the Poetical Works of Henry Lawson, first published in 19, a beautiful little poem just simply called Knocking Around. Weary old wife with the bucket and cow. How's your son Jack and where is he now? Haggard old eyes that turn to the west. Boys will be boys, he's gone with the rest. Grief without tears, and grief without sound. Somewhere up country he's knocking around. Knocking around with a vagabond crew. Does for himself what a mother would do. Maybe in trouble and maybe hard up. Maybe in want of a bite or a sup. Dead of the fever, or lost in the drought. Lonely old mother, he's knocking about. Wiry old man at the tail of a plough. Heard of Jack lately, and where is he now? Pauses a moment, his forehead to wipe, drops the rope reins while he feels for his pipe, scratches his grey head in sorrow or doubt. Somewhere or other he's knocking about. Knocking about on the runs in the west, holding his own with the worst and the best, breaking in horses and risking his neck, droving or shearing and making a check. Straight as a sapling, 6 foot and sound, Jack is all right when he's knocking around. That made me think of a gentleman from Bega who did a little bit of knocking around himself. I'm looking at the moment at the 1914 edition of Fred Johns's Annual of Prominent People in Australia. This is only the second year that he'd printed it in 1914. I've read it from cover to cover. It's one of those delightful books with the heavy paper. And in it, I only found one person in 1914 who'd reached some sort of national fame. This book eventually became the Who's Who of Australia, and then it became the database of national biography. And this entry was Charles James Kirkland, editor and sole proprietor of the Northern Territory Times at Darwin, Northern Territory. Born at Bega, New South Wales, on the 5th of June, 1860. Son of James Kirkland, farmer and pioneer of the Bega district. Educated at local public school, which probably means just down the road here from the museum. It opened about that time. He has had an eventful career. He left home at 16 and after journalistic experience at Bathurst and Sydney, took charge of the Northern Territory Times in 1878. In 1881, he went cruising between Darwin and Timor and adjacent islands and returned to the territory in 1886 when he acquired an interest in the newspaper North Australia. Afterwards, he spent some time in pearling operations and in 1900 repurchased the Northern Territory Times. He was accorded a popular and unique demonstration at Darwin last year after imprisonment for editorial comment on judicial proceedings in connection with a court case. His address is simply given as Darwin, Northern Territory. It's accompanied by an obituary, and it's just a little bit too tiny to read. I'll put that into larger print for another day. But a couple of years back, I said to my younger brother, Stephen Farram, what do you know about Charles James Kirkland? My brother's at the Charles Darwin University and he's an historian up there. They do a colloquium every year. Sometimes he's the host of that. He always delivers a paper. Being with the university, he's got to publish. Everybody has to publish. So he did this book called Charles James Kirkland, The Life and Times of a Pioneer Newspaper Man in the Top End of Australia. He actually thought when I asked him this question that, you know, he'd look and there'd be an entry in the National Database of Biography about him, but there turned out not to be. This is from the acknowledgements. This book would probably not exist except for my brother Graham, who asked me what I knew about Charles Kirkland. This is my answer, and it's a nice fat book. And he did come back to Bega at some time. Stephen credits him with possibly circumnavigating Australia by steamer from Darwin. And there are lots of good stories in there, which I'll come to another time. I certainly will bring that back up. I've just been asked by my producer today to inquire of my brother about another gentleman called Bill Umbras, who was described as a Darwin bard. That'll be a good project for my brother and possibly the beginning of another book. We'll see how that goes. So knocking around, in the foyer here at the museum we have a framed collection of pre-decimal notes. Now, one kind of knocking about is to be a hawker. And in the same book, Poetical Works of Henry Lawson, I found a very, very small poem on hawkers. Dust, dust, dust and a dog. Oh, the sheepdog won't be last where the long, long shadow of the old bay horse with the shadow of his mate is cast. A brick-brown woman with her brick-brown kids and a man with his head half-mast. The feed bags hung and the bedding slung and the blackened bucket made fast where the tailboard clings to the tucker and things. So the hawker's band goes past. Now, George Tradd, people in living memory can recall him coming to their properties. I read a little bit from Tales from the Forgotten Corner a little while back, which spoke about Perico and him visiting out there in the next valley down south at one time. But he did travel all around, and the wheels of his van, which is in the Bega Pioneers Museum, are steel, so people could actually hear him coming. And one day I had a gentleman who was 6 foot tall, and he said, "Have you got George Tradd's wagon?" And I said, "Yes, we have. You come with me." I took him out the back, and he looked at it, and he said, "I thought it was bigger." We all do that if we revisit something from our childhood. But he said, we could hear the wheels, and when the wheels were coming, we all hid under the house. But the idea of the hawker with his half-bent head at half-mast, George was so comfortable with his animals that he was a bit, with his one horse, that he was a bit notorious for actually going to sleep at the wheel. So that's interesting. And it's quite impressive to see that wagon and see where he would have sat, because he actually sat within the wagon behind the windows and the rains came in through there. So I thought that was good. I wanted to mention Hawker's. There is another Hawker's license in the museum. It's in one of the back sheds. It's black with white writing. H.J. Sharp, licensed Hawker, Bega. We'll have to look him up. The Sharps were a famous family here. They did lots of things. Nita can remember one of the people having a haberdashery here. They made soft drink, early soft drink. There are a couple of demijohns with their name on it in the museum. But here we are in the foyer of the Bega Pioneers Museum, and of course this used to be a hotel, and I've done a couple of hotel poems, but I found one that's a little bit earlier than all of the things that I've done so far, and it's simply called The Shanty on the Rise. Now, there used to be a shanty on the rise in the Brogo Pass. That road, which is beautiful and been through many modifications, the bridge has been washed away on occasion, and they had to get bullocks in to take loads across the Brogo River because it's quite steep there. They used bullocks to actually rebuild the bridge. But there was a shanty right up on the top of the rise, and it was a bit dangerous to come down the other side from there, and people were injured and hurt as wagons and, all fell off. This is also from Poetical Works of Henry Lawson, so it was published in 1918, as I say, or 1915. Anyway, very, very early. And of course he's already written it, so what date it is exactly I don't know. But The Shanty on the Rise. When the caravans of wool teams climbed the ranges from the west, on a spur among the mountains stood the bullock driver's rest. It was built of bark and saplings and was rather rough inside, but 'twas good enough for bushmen in the careless days that died. Just a quiet little shanty kept by something in disguise, as the bushmen called the landlord of the shanty on the rise. City swells who do the royal would have called the shanty low, but 'twas better far and cleaner than some tony pubs we know. For the patrons of the shanty had the principles of men, and the spieler, if he struck it, wasn't welcome there again. You could smoke and drink in quiet, yarn, or perhaps soliloquise with a decent lot of fellows in the shanty on the rise. 'Twas the bullock driver's haven when his team was on the road, and the wagon wheels were groaning as they ploughed beneath the load. I remember how the teamsters struggled on while it was light, just to camp within a cooey of the shanty for the night. And I think the very bullocks raised their heads and fixed their eyes on the candle in the window of the shanty on the rise. And the bullock bells were clanking from the marshes on the flats as we hurried to the shanty, where we hung our dripping hats. Then we took a drop of something that was bought at our desire, and we stood with streaming moleskins in the kitchen by the fire. Oh, it roared upon a fireplace of the good old-fashioned size when the rain came down the chimney of the shanty on the rise. They got up a Christmas party in the shanty long ago, while we camped with Jimmy Nowlett on the riverbank below. Poor old Jim was in his glory. They'd elected him MC, for there wasn't such another raving lunatic as he. "Mr. Nowlett! Mr. Swaller!" shouted something in disguise, and we walked into the parlour of the shanty on the rise. There is little real pleasure in the city where I am. There's a soiree round the corner with its mockery and sham, but a fellow can be happy when around the room he whirls in a party up the country with the jolly country girls. Why, at time I almost fancied I was dancing on the skies when I danced with Mary Carey in the shanty on the rise. Jimmy came to me and whispered, and I muttered, "Go along." But he shouted, "Mr. Swaller will oblige us with a song." And at first I said I wouldn't, and I shammed a little too, till the girls began to whisper, "Mr. Swaller, Mr. Swaller, now, ah, do." So I sang a song of something about the love that never dies, and the chorus shook the rafters of the shanty on the rise. Jimmy burst his concertina, and the bullock drivers went for the corpse of Joe the fiddler, who was sleeping in his tent. Joe was tired and had lumbago, and he wouldn't come, he said. But the case was very urgent, so they pulled him out of bed and they fetched him, for the bushman knew that something in disguise had a cure for Joe's lumbago in the shanty on the rise. Jim and I went rather quiet while escorting Mary home, neath the stars that hung in clusters near and distant from the dome. And we walked in such a silence, being lost in reverie, that we heard the settlers' matches softly rustle on the tree. And I wondered who would win her when she said her sweet goodbye. But she died at 21 and was buried on the rise. I suppose the shanty vanished from the ranges long ago, and the girls are mostly married to the chaps I used to know. My old chums are in the distance. Some have crossed the borderline, but I fancy still their glasses kink against the rim of mine. And upon the very greenest spot that lies in my fondest recollection stands the shanty on the rise. I was thinking of the word enunciate and how careful you have to be about pronouncing words properly. Yeah. I made some slips there, but our word announce, the Pope, when he sends somebody out to visit the congregations, that person is called the nuncio, and his job is to make whatever bull the Pope has just issued something that people have to pay attention to. Thank you very much.
Graham Farram is the former proprietor of Mumford's Books here in Bega. He's also had a long affiliation with the Bega Pioneers Museum, where he spends a bit of his time these days. And on a weekly basis, on a Monday morning at about 11 o'clock, you'll find him in the front room of the Bega Pioneers Museum, reciting poetry and reading segments from non-fiction books and generally informing a bit of an audience about the goings-on of characters and areas around the Bega Valley. Graham will join us here on the local update on a weekly basis with the next little piece of reading and general chat about Bega. Imagine spending your working life in the pursuit of a character that you almost never see. Chris Allen is a threatened species officer from the Office of Environment and Heritage in New South Wales, and his Higgs boson is the koala population of the south coast of New South Wales. In 2014, I joined him and a team of volunteers on a random survey of the bush in the Tanger State Forest, looking for evidence of koalas around that region. We're in Tanger State Forest on a fire trail. There's eight of us here, a couple of environmental science students. The majority of us are locals from this particular region. I've lived in this area almost all my life, and most of the locals are aware that there are koalas in this bit of forest. But it's only in recent years that we've had a clear picture of how many koalas are out here and where exactly they are. We're lucky to have an incredibly knowledgeable koala researcher living in this region. And today, we're helping out on a long-term survey.
My name's Chris Allen. I work with the Office of Environment and Heritage, and my job title is Senior Threatened Species Officer, but my main focus has been on koalas.
So, just describe for me the boundaries of the area that these surveys cover.
Essentially, it's between the Bermagui River to the north and the Bega River to the south. What I'll do is I'll mark this waypoint so we don't have any mistake about where we come back to.
The fire trail that we're on runs along the ridge, the top of a hill. It gets pretty steep. There's a few rocks around and a lot of fallen branches, so we have to be pretty careful where we put our feet.
Now, how are we doing? Is everybody all right? You got something itching?
I think just bitten. Just an ant, I think.
Okay. Can you tuck those in?
I can, yes.
Now, just to share a little bit of history, the trigger for the surveys that commenced here in 2007 were a report from two young Kurilates who were riding down here on bikes, and they saw a female with young go across this trail. And it really looks, you know, you look at this country and you think, my goodness, really, no self-respecting koala would come near it because it is almost pure silvertop ash. But in fact, there's quite a diversity of species.
What is the significance, do you think, of this particular population of koalas?
Well, look, one thing to say about this population is that it is what we call a low-density population. The animals are widely scattered, with each animal having a large home range, which may be up to 50 hectares. The koala numbers might be low, but they extend over a very large area. And I suspect that this is a characteristic of many koala populations. And these koalas are clearly using this kind of habitat in a very sophisticated way.
I'm Victoria Reid and I live here in Wappingo.
And what's your interest in this koala program?
Oh, well, they've had a rough past and a rough current life, and they need someone to think about them and do everything they can to help sustain their numbers. I haven't seen a koala around here. My neighbour has heard them, and I've certainly seen some scats, but I've never seen a wild koala up a tree.
Well, I grew up in this region and neither have I, so there you go.
I'm Pauline Mendes. I'm a local resident. I live in Tanger.
How long have you been here?
I've lived in the area for over 25 years.
Have you ever seen a koala?
No, I haven't.
Look, we hardly ever see koalas. Let's be clear about this. In these forests, being the coastal forests, probably in the past 15 years, I've seen maybe 7 or 8 koalas. So very, very few.
Yeah, look at this. Look at this.
Straight away.
How about that?
Wow.
Fresh ass. This is brilliant, this pellet. Just brilliant.
There's another one? Or is it?
Yeah.
So just describe for me what you've got in your hand.
Okay, well, we've got 2 koala pellets here. They're an olive green colour, shaped actually like a large olive pip. A distinctive characteristics of koala pellets is the longitudinal ridgelines.
So fairly fresh. How long ago do you reckon the koala's been around?
These would be probably only 3 or 4 days old at most. Actually, that one there looks quite fresh. So the koala would have climbed up, and often as they're climbing up, they'll drop a pellet or two. Okay. So we mark this. We mark every location where we find pellets.
Okay, so we just found 5 pellets under a tree as we were walking through the bush. But the one thing that keeps getting hammered home here is that this survey has to be unbiased, which means we can only measure the activity of the koalas inside specific survey zones, which are dictated by grid lines on a map. Those particular pellets were under a tree literally just outside one of our survey sites, so they won't be included in this particular survey. But it is a pretty cool way to kick things off.
Basically, we have now come to our location that's on the map. What we do here is we establish a centre tree, and our survey site is what we call a radial plot. Our first task is to select 30 trees, and the only criteria we use are that the trees are alive and that they are over 150 millimetres diameter at breast height. And so we work up sequentially to 30 trees.
Oh, okay.
So we got 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11.
My name's Carly, and I've helped out with Chris and his team for the past year or so.
But what are you actually up to with the tape and the trees?
Oh, I'm checking for any trees that are above 150 mils diameter breast height, and then marking them with the flagging tape. And you call out the number so we know when we've got up to 30 trees. But before we mark them, we've got to look up, check they're alive. That's a big one.
Hello? 19. Thank you very much.
20, 21. Do you reckon this tree's actually alive?
Oh, God. Okay.
It's like died out at the top and then regrown.
Unless that could be a vine.
You kidding?
Because a lot of the leaves I'm seeing are from this tree. Yeah.
That's the last one, Kylie. I work on my hands and knees, but people may want to squat. It's quite a lot of bending over here. You just need to watch your back. So this technique is used across much of the koala range now. There are people scratching around in the bush like this all over the joint.
Just describe for me what you're up to right now.
Yeah, hi, I'm Norm. I'm working close to the trunk of the tree because that's where most of it droppings tend to be. We just don't have time to scratch through the litter for many meters from a tree. So basically it's just 1 meter round, and we've covered 50% of the probability of finding some sort of marking of a koala. We can't see any koalas here, but the droppings are always there. So if we can find them, we can build up a picture of where they are, where they're moving.
This survey method that we use, it's a relatively non-intrusive method. And that's really, really important. You know, we don't have to haul the animals out of trees and stick collars on them and stuff like that. We can also get the DNA from the population. We can also tell whether there's mother and young around, understanding what they're feeding, the social dynamics. The difficulty is that it is resource hungry. We've done up to 600 locations through the forest. 18,000 trees searched for koala pellets. That's a lot of trees.
So how are your knees after all that?
Oh, look, my knees are still pretty good, really. So far, so good.
This looks like wallaby to me.
I've got a wombat, I think.
Should we get excited? What have you found, Carly?
Not excited. It's fairly fine on the inside like a koala poo, but the outside's very grassy, so I'd say it's a bit of wallaby poo, unfortunately.
It's got to be the only thing you do in the world where you get excited about finding poo.
Totally.
Even if you're the best searcher in the world, you're likely to miss them if there's a lot of dense undergrowth, just because you can't scratch around as easily. And sometimes, like in the draw, you can be so focused but you accidentally move a leaf that's got a koala pellet curled up in it, it's just one of those things.
So how many searches do you reckon you would go without finding anything?
I think Chris said it's roughly 1 in 5 plots. It does depend on the area. Other days you strike it lucky and every plot you go to has some, so it's so variable.
Last tree for the plot, girls. Any luck?
Oh, not yet.
Never say never.
That's it. Every now and then a pellet has been found on the last tree.
The last tree, yes, it has happened.
So we've been in the bush for about 4 hours now. We've surveyed 2 sites and had no luck whatsoever. It really does say something, I guess, about the dedication of the guys who come out here looking for these pellets. So, Chris, it's kind of amazing to think that you've built this incredibly detailed data set for koala populations, and all the information that you've gathered was on your hands and knees looking for their poo.
Look, I mean, there's no question in my mind that the method that we use is a fantastically informative way of learning about koalas. And, okay, so the focus is koala poo, but the ramifications of the work is just so big. The science behind it, the understanding of a koala ecology, understanding of the animal, all those things flow from that. I just regard it as an amazing privilege to be involved in this work. So, it's a great part of my life.
Chris Allen is a Senior Threatened Species Officer with the Office of Environment and Heritage here in New South Wales. And I joined that survey team in winter of 2014, looking for evidence of koalas in the Tanger State Forest. As you are no doubt aware, in the time since those surveys were done, we've recently been through a pretty severe fire event, and one can only hope that at least some of the koala population is still in those forests. I have no doubt that Chris Allen and his team at the Office of Environment and Heritage will be out in the bush surveying again soon, looking for evidence of those koalas, and I'm sure that he would always appreciate your help in those projects. You're listening to The Local Update, a podcast and radio program looking at issues around the Bega Valley. My name is Indy Wood, and this program is produced by Indy Media with the assistance of 93.7 Edge FM. If you've got an issue or event that you think is worth promoting, you can hit me up. indymedia.com.au is the website where you'll find details on how to get in touch. Or, of course, indymedia82 is the handle of all social media for Indy Media. We'll catch you next week. Thank you so much for your time. Thanks to all those guests from this week. Bye now.